Well, good morning, everybody. I'd like to start by saying good morning to Kevin Olson. Judge Olson joins us for his first case today, and on behalf of the court, I'd like to welcome you. And also note for the audience that Kevin is somebody who's spent his entire career in public service, and that career has been marked by actual service. As a judge advocate, as an assistant U.S. attorney, and as a career civil servant at the Department of Justice. It's a great pleasure to have you on our bench and an honor to serve with you.
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker. It's a privilege to be here.
I now would recognize Captain Warner for a motion.
May it please the court. I move the admission of Captain Timothy C. Erickson of the Bar of Michigan, Captain Daniel M. Goldberg of the Bar of Virginia, and Captain Jacqueline E. Shea of the Bar of Michigan. I have examined their credentials on file in the office of the clerk. I am satisfied that they possess the qualifications for membership in the Bar of this court.
Thank you very much. Let us consult. You could be the first judge to ever dissent on one of these, but I think we have concurrence. Could you please administer the oath?
Please raise your right hand. You solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States and that you will conduct yourselves as attorneys and counselors of this court uprightly and according to law, so help you God.
Well, thank you very much. Congratulations on joining the bar of the court. Thank you for your service as judge advocates, and I can see from your ribbons that you've had extensive service already. I much appreciate it. Thank you for the motion, and we will now call United States v. Hines. Please sit. Yeah, you can stand there if you want for the whole thing. The court now calls United States v. Hines. Since this is a certified case, the government will go first.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Campbell Warner, and along with Major Catherine Brantley, I represent the government. This court should reverse the Army Court of Criminal Appeals and affirm the findings and sentence, as the specifications of Charge 2 were each properly charged in the aggregate as single ongoing offenses. It's unfortunate that with the Army Court's decision, even though it's a per curiam summary disposition, we essentially still have a split between the service courts, with the Army Court treating ongoing VAH fraud arising out of a single act of fraud as separate offenses basically once every month, versus the Navy Court in the United States v. Lopresti applying a three-part test, and if that test is satisfied, then VAH fraud or similar ongoing fraud that arises from a single larceny that arises out of a single act of fraud is charged as a single ongoing offense. And the government urges this court to reverse the Army Court and apply the Navy Court's test in Lopresti.
Do you like the Lopresti? I mean, do you like it? do you think that's the right test, or would you just stick with the block burger? The impulse is single. I understand you're arguing reverse, but reverse and adopt the Lopresti test as is, or reverse and adopt the following 23-part test, or stick with the Blockburger language, or do what?
Your Honor, the government asks this court to reverse the Army Court and adopt the three-part Lopresti test. The government's not asking for anything else beyond that. The Lopresti test holds that a single larceny should be charged when, one, an accused intends to steal several items, such as VAH on a monthly basis. Two, the means of committing the larceny is through a single act of fraud, such as submitting a falsified document, or with respect to specification three of charge two, failing to update personnel records. And part three, the owner of the property delivers the items to the accused, but the delivery happens at different times and dates.
What about the Fifth Circuit Billingsley language?
Well, sir, I think the Lopresti test comports well with Billingsley. Billingsley basically states that when you have a defendant who intends to steal several items, he sets up a mechanism by which the takings are going to occur on a recurring basis, then you have a single ongoing theft. And there are two counts at issue in Billingsley, and I want to be clear which one we're talking about. Count 11 dealt with the defendant stealing checks from students at different times, and the Fifth Circuit found that there was not enough evidence that that was an intent to steal all of those things arising at the same time. However, count 10, which was properly held to be a single offense and therefore was properly charged in the aggregate, that dealt with basically what the appellant in this case, or the defendant in this case, did, where he's receiving a recurring payment on a regular basis and he basically used a single act of fraud to set up that mechanism. So Lopresti basically comports with the reasoning of Billingsley, as well as Pappy, Parisian, and Smith, which are from the 4th, 7th, and 8th circuits, I believe. Now, in addition to comporting with federal law, Lopresti test also picks up on United States versus Bolden. And there may be a debate as to whether the language from Bolden is a holding in the case or whether it's dicta. But if this court finds that it's dicta, it's at least very persuasive dicta, and it comports again with reasoning from federal law. In Bolden, if you'll remember, the primary issue was whether the appellant's marriage was a sham that entitled him to any form of BAH. However, this court said at the outset, even if the appellant's marriage was not a sham, he was receiving $50 more a month than he was entitled to due to an act of fraud. And in the aggregate, that $50 every month for 5.5 months substantially exceeded the $100 threshold at the time. So Bolden certainly indicates that this court has, if not as an exact holding, at least in very persuasive dicta, said that aggregation of BAH larceny is permissible in such cases. Now, in addition to comporting with federal law, Lopresti is also good policy, and this is going to be especially important with the specification 2 of charge 2. And if you recall, specification 2 dealt with the theft of the family separation allowance in Afghanistan. Very clear that no single monthly amount there exceeded $500, but the aggregate amount was well over $500. So under the Lopresti test, because those 14 thefts were as of a single act of fraud, the submission of the falsified paperwork in Afghanistan, charging the aggregate is one offense, one conviction, and a maximum of 10 years confinement. If the Army Corps' logic is adopted and it's a separate larceny every single month, then we're looking at 14 specifications of larceny of government property less than $500, 14 convictions, and since it carries a one-year penalty, a maximum of 14 years confinement. So actually charging it in the aggregate harms the appellant because it's more convictions and greater prison time.
If this were a time ago, a little old-fashioned times, and you went and received your pay in person, you know, the guy with the cash and the 45, and so you've submitted your BHA paperwork, but then you go each month and you get your pay paid out.
Yes, sir.
How do you apply your analysis, your Lopresti test, or whatever you're presenting today?
Well, sir, I don't think that that changes the analysis at all because the single act of fraud occurs when the paperwork, the falsified paperwork is submitted. So in your example, a soldier in 1945 submits falsified paperwork and he receives that BAH on a monthly basis. The single act of fraud is not him showing up to receive the pay every month. It's when he submits that falsified document and then sets up that mechanism to receive those monies on a recurring basis. The fact that we've gone to direct deposit nowadays doesn't really change the analysis because a single act of fraud sets up that mechanism and the appellant clearly intends to steal several items arising at the same time because BAH, as everyone in the military knows, is an ongoing recurrent thing. Assuming EPS is doing its job, you receive BAH like clockwork. So I don't think it really changes the analysis at all, sir.
Now, you refer to a single act of fraud.
Yes, sir.
So should this court be drawing a distinction between the first two specifications that refer to stealing the funds as compared to the third specification, where not only do we have wrongful appropriation, but we have the accused stating that each month he reflected on that fact that he received those funds and thought about returning it but didn't?
Based on those facts, this court could draw a distinction, Your Honor, but I also think it's important to look at the intent. He's receiving that BAH on a monthly basis, and this was the longest of the crimes because this occurred for, I believe, 30-some-odd months. I don't have the exact number. It occurred for well over 2 years, almost three. So at some point in there, you have to wonder, or you have to look at, what was your intent? 2 months, 3 months, I think there's a good argument that maybe you didn't have the intent to steal these items at once, but once you get to a certain point down the line, you have to look at the appellant's actions as well. And that goes to the appellant's intent, which is the first prong of the Lopresti test. So it's not just a single act of fraud, you look at his intent as well. And that is going to be fact dependent in every case, Your Honor. We're not saying that there's a blanket rule where if you receive BAH for 6 months, 12 months at a time, that you're not entitled to. It's always going to be charged in the aggregate. That's going to be a matter of fact that is case dependent.
Well, wasn't he entitled to single BAH?
He was not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Sir, that is discussed during the plea inquiry and also in the stipulation.
Well, I know what he pled to. I know what he stipulated to. But wasn't he, as a matter of law, entitled to single BAH? He was a single troop, and he wasn't living in the barracks.
Well, sir, the stipulation of fact, paragraph 9, addresses this under Fort Bragg and Fort Campbell policies.
Well, there's this thing about you should have gotten permission to live off base.
Correct.
And it appears to be different between the two bases. One of them, it appears to be a pretty clear rule that you don't live off base. That's Bragg. You don't live off base unless the commander says you can. The other one seems a lot more squishy. Campbell seems a lot more squishy.
I disagree.
It's less clear that there's some duty at Campbell to go get permission.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, and on that pages 41 and 42 of the joint appendix, paragraph 9, the accused never applied for and received authority to live off post and receive BAH as a single soldier without dependents. It was installation policy at both Fort Bragg and Fort Campbell that an E-5 would be...
Well, but it seems to read differently between the two posts. I know what STIP says.
Well, Your Honor,
all I'm saying is it seems to be a lot squishier at Campbell than it seems at Bragg. And if that's the case, is there some argument that you got to set off what he should have gotten against the actual amount?
In these facts, Your Honor, I don't think so, because the appellant, or the accused, excuse me, pled guilty, agreed to the stipulation of fact, and this is also addressed during the plea inquiry, Joint Appendix 28 and 29. The amount that he stole total at Fort Campbell was $5,328, so the military judge...
Right. No, I know what the judge said, and I know what he said, but go ahead. One more question.
Yes, sir.
Is cash military property?
In this case, it is, Your Honor.
How so? Because cash is utterly fungible, and it's all sitting in the treasury. It's not the Army's cash. It's the Treasury's cash, under Title 31. And cash is cash. So how's it military property?
Well, sir, first of all, these monies are, it's congressional appropriations. So Congress specifically says, Army, you have to use this pot of money for these purposes, this pot of money for these purposes. And we don't go really into a ton of detail in the stipulation as how they treat us on fiscal law or anywhere else in the plea inquiry. But basic allowance for housing is military property.
Do you have a case that stands for that proposition, counsel?
Do
you have a case from this court or any other court that specifically says that it's military property?
I do not have one specifically in point, Your Honor, except for Bolden, where the appellant was charged with, I believe, larceny of military property as well as conspiracy. But that, again, was not the primary issue in that case. But to answer your question, I would say the money is allocated for a specific military purpose. So I think that puts it into the area of military property. It's used for a specific military purpose.
With respect to specification 3, what was the government's theory of larceny? What type of a larceny? I understand it's wrongful appropriation, but I mean the other two are larceny by false pretenses. What was the theory of larceny in specification 3?
Your Honor, I believe it was the same one, and the appellant ended up pleading guilty to wrongful appropriation because of his claim that he always intended to give the money back to the Army at some point.
Was the act by which he committed a false pretense in that case?
Failure to update his personnel records, Your Honor. So to conclude briefly with the first certified issue, the government urges this court to reverse the Army Court of Criminal Appeals and adopt the Navy Court's test in U.S. Naval Presti, which would result in all three specifications properly being charged in the aggregate and all findings being affirmed as they were by the military judge. Now, should this court decline to adopt the Presti test, that brings us to the second certified issue. And if you reach a second certified issue having rejected the Presti, obviously specification 2, dealing with the family separation allowance, all that could be affirmed would be larceny of less than $500 per month due to the amount of the family separation allowance. However, the Army Court misread the record with respect to specifications 1 and 3. As Judge Stupien and I previously discussed, the amount that was taken every month was not the difference between BAH with and BAH without, the difference being less than $500. The appellant wasn't entitled to any amount of that BAH due to being a single soldier, no other dependents, being required by Fort Campbell and Fort Bragg policies to live in the barracks. And those amounts, as laid out in the stipulation of fact, clearly were above $500 every month. So should this court reject the Presti test, appellant's convictions for specifications 1 and 3 for larceny and wrongful appropriation for those respective amounts may and should still be affirmed.
If we do that, do we need to kick it back for a sentence rehearing, for a reassessment?
No, Your Honor, I think under Sales, this would be good to go to the Army Court. the Army Court already assessed the sentence based on the lower convictions for larceny and wrongful appropriation, less than $500. So if this court reinstates those greater convictions, I still don't see a need to remand for a reassessment. I think the sentence could be affirmed on its own.
In your brief, you essentially say that there was no ambiguity in anyone's mind about this issue of the BAH with and BAH without. Then why in the stipulation did trial counsel even include information about the BAH without?
I have information about that, sir. It's outside the record, but I did speak with the trial counsel. I'm happy to discuss if this court wants to.
I defer to the chief judge on that.
Traditionally, we stay within the record. You could always ask for the record to be supplemented.
That's
but
fine.
Probably not necessary here.
Basically, the information with that is not in the record, sir. I agree that it would be cleaner if that information had not been included. But it did create, I want to clear this up, ultimately, the issue was resolved. Now, was there ambiguity at the outset of the plea colloquy? Yes, there was, and that's why the military judge went back, pages 28 and 29 of the joint appendix, to clear up that confusion. And then once the confusion was cleared up, we had a provident plea. So the stipulation is a little sticky, but the military judge did exactly what he was supposed to do, which is resolve whatever ambiguities appeared to result. So as a result, there is no ambiguity remaining, and the plea is provident. Any further questions?
Without further questions, thank you, counsel.
Yes,
and we'll now hear from appellee, I guess.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Bob Michaels, and together with Colonel Kevin Boyle, we represent the appellee, Sergeant Sean Hines. The Army Corps did not abuse its discretion under Article 66C of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and its opinion contains no clearly erroneous findings of fact. As such, this court should affirm the Army Corps' decision. The Army Corps correctly found inconsistencies in the record of trial between statements of Sergeant Hines during the care inquiry with the military judge and the statements contained within the stipulation of fact regarding what money Sergeant Hines believed he was entitled to receive. These inconsistencies could not be resolved by the Army Corps and cannot be resolved by this court as they appear in the plain black and white print of the record of trial and were not resolved by the military judge. Throughout the course of the province inquiry, Sergeant Hines referred on five separate occasions that when talking about the theft, he was talking about theft of BAH with entitlements. The stipulation of facts has the statement, if Sergeant Hines had not been wrongfully appropriating or stealing BAH, he would have received BAH.
The first stipulation, BAH with entitlements equals BAH with dependents?
That's the interpretation from the record, because he continually...
Because I've never heard the term. I mean, BAH is an entitlement. With dependents or without?
Yes, Your Honor. And the terms, adding to the confusion, the terms seem to be used interchangeably throughout the province inquiry.
But we take it to be BAH with dependents.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because that is also surrounded by the discussion about when his divorce was finalized, what documents he turned in, when he did not. And again, while he admits that I took the entire amount, there's also the chart there, and it says in the stipulation of fact, in plain language, it says, had he not been stealing, he would have been entitled to BAH.
Well, would he have been, or what about the government's point that he never took the necessary steps to live off base and draw BAH without entitlement, without dependents?
Yes, Your Honor, the facts are developed a little more clearly in that regard as to Fort Bragg, but there's no discussion about that in regards to Fort Campbell. The policy is not included in the record of trial either. There's no indication, there's no questions asked about whether that policy was punitive. And they continue to ask...
Well, punitive or not punitive, if there's a regulation in place and he doesn't do it, then presumably he hasn't fulfilled the condition precedent to receive it.
Yes, Your Honor, but the parties still agree.
It doesn't have to be a punitive regulation. Here's your punitive regulation. It's called the code.
Yes, Your Honor, but the parties still agreed in the record that he would have been entitled to the BAH without entitlements rate.
And had he done what?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, if he fulfilled the condition, which he failed to, which it also says he did not do.
Correct, Your Honor. But the military judge also notes in the, well, it's not the joint appendix, in the sentencing argument of the defense counsel, he said specifically, so what you really have to look at, particularly as it relates to his mens rea, is the difference between the two numbers. It's just not clear, based off that record, whether he believed he was entitled to BAH at the without rate or the BAH with entitlements rate.
Well, it's not just that he believed it. Was his belief reasonable?
Your Honor, if you look at the facts and if you look at what's in the stipulation of fact, I believe that that he believed it was reasonable, and I think there is an argument that it was reasonable, based off of the military judge's question, that had you gone through this, you would have been entitled to these monies.
Now I'm more confused. Where does that leave us? Had you done it, you would have been, but you didn't, so you aren't. So therefore, you stole it all.
Correct, Your Honor, and that, I think, is part of the confusion in this case and part of the ambiguity here, which the Army Court found in the record of trial, is you have these conflicting statements. You have the use of BAH with and BAH without seemingly interchangeably, and when you take all these facts together, it does create an ambiguity such that the Army Court did not believe that he was proven to those offenses.
Well, Counsel, there is some confusion in the record. I'll grant you that, but on JA-29, the area we're talking about right now, the military judge point blank asks him, okay, were you entitled to any part of the $5,328? He said, no, I was not, Your Honor. That's the total amount that was charged.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you get around that? I mean, obviously the military judge was a little confused, so he asked him the ultimate question.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think when you take that in conjunction with the other statements and the statements that are in the actual trial transcript regarding, you know, even the sentencing argument of the defense counsel, there is an ambiguity as to what it is that he felt he was pleading guilty to, and that's the ambiguity that the Army Corps, using its Article 66 authority, found to question the plea.
Were you done with that question?
Yes, Your Honor.
The Army CCA obviously rejects the Lopresti test, but there's not a lot of analysis. They just sort of say it's a monthly thing, monthly larceny. Can you go through the Lopresti test and indicate in an opinion format why you would or would not adopt those elements as the test?
Yes, Your Honor, and as I would note at the outset of that the Army Corps didn't just not apply Lopresti, they said under the circumstances of this case. And I believe that goes back to the ambiguity that the Army Corps found in the facts. However, taking that, the Lopresti test, first we believe that the court would have to find that there was the findings of fact in the Army Corps were clearly erroneous in regards to the ambiguities that were in the
I'm not in, just do the law piece first,
yes,
please, before you. So let's set the test up before you apply your facts to the test.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not conceding anything if you agree with the test. You don't. That's not a secret concession that your facts meet the test. Okay.
Understood, Your Honor. The first problem being the accused intends to steal several items. Applying that to the facts here.
Was there anything wrong with that as a test to determine whether you're dealing with one or multiple larcenies?
No, Your Honor. However, I would note that in regards to the idea of aggregation is not provided for in the code, as we know in our brief. And absent ambiguity in the language of the code, the court should enforce the plain language of the code.
Your argument with the Lopresti test is not there's anything wrong with the Lopresti test. You just don't see it as consistent with the code.
Precisely, Your Honor.
So you think it's a wonderful test. It's just not available when the code is pointing in a
different
direction.
We have no specific issues with the Lopresti test. We have an issue with whether or not that the Navy Marine Corps court properly decided that on proper grounds, considering that the holding itself says that they were making this decision as a matter of policy. We do not believe that it was the court's position to make that decision on a matter of policy, given that the language of the code does not provide for aggregation. The code specifically says it allows for aggregation of multiple items stolen from multiple people at one time, not multiple items stolen over a period of time.
Well, what's wrong with the logic in Billings?
There's nothing wrong with the logic of it, Your Honor. However, as we know in our brief, that statute had a specific provision allowing for aggregation in it. We lack that in this case, and we lack that in our code.
Your position is that there can never be an aggregation under the UCMJ statute?
As the code exists now, that's a congressional decision and a decision for the Congress and the President. And the language just simply isn't there. And absent that language and the ambiguity, the court should enforce the language as it exists in the code. And when the government, in its brief, argues that it would result in an absurd number of charges or specifications or result in overcharging, that's simply not the case. The government has a mechanism with which they can deal with those types of situations, and that's to charge on diverse occasions. They did not do that in this case. So to argue that as a result, as a default, they would have to, for example, in this case, have 40-plus specifications of larceny of fractions of a cent, that's just simply not the case. They have on diverse occasions to
So you would end up with just one charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you could do BHA theft for 20 years and end up with one count?
Yes, Your Honor. And then you also have...
And that appropriately captures the essence of the criminal offense.
Your Honor,
one count for under $500 on diverse occasions if you've done it for 20 years.
Your Honor, when you have the language of the code being as clear as it is, it's not clear that Congress intended for aggregation to be there. So based off the plain language of the code, that was the congressional intent. And that was, in fact, what Congress said would be an appropriate punishment or appropriate liability given those offenses.
So because Congress did not express its intent, your position is that this court is forbidden from going into that territory?
Not necessarily your intent, Your Honor, but it's not in the plain language of the statute. And there's not ambiguity on this point. It's just not there. So given that the Lopresti court said that this was a matter of policy, we believe that decision rests on questionable grounds. And even if this court should adopt Lopresti, we do not believe that it can be applied to the appellee's case, because the mere fact that the government is asking for clarification, asking this court to adopt this policy, demonstrates that there was ambiguity in the code.
Well, counsel, why do you keep on calling it a policy? I mean, I understand that was what the Lopresti court said, but in each of these in each specification, right, you agree that the government's theory of liability was that he committed a false pretense, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, and how many times did he, in specification one, specification two, it was an affirmative act of making a false statement, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how many times did he do that? Once, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in the last case, it was that he failed to update his personnel file, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how many times did he do that?
Once.
Right? And so when you consider the facts of this particular case, and you consider RCM 307C4, which says that what substantially one transaction shouldn't be made into multiple different specifications, why is that a policy as opposed to taking the facts of this case as they are and charging it as three different specifications as opposed to 50 different specifications?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the facts in that regard are as clear, because if you look at the stipulation of fact, the stipulation of fact refers more than those just singular acts. It talks about him looking at the LES on a monthly basis, about things that he was doing to keep this going. So for the government to argue that it was based off a single act or a single transaction, I don't think is accurate, because that doesn't appear to be the theory that was advanced at trial. And even if this court should adopt the Lopresti test, that test and that decision should not be applied to Sergeant Hines' case, and the decision of the lower court should stand because of lack of notice and ambiguity. The fact that the government is asking this court to adopt a new test is an indication that it wasn't clear, and Sergeant Hines was not on notice of what it is that the aggregation was a possibility. And ambiguity, when the language of the statute is unclear, the ambiguity must be resolved.
Well, on the notice argument, I mean, certainly the specification had the aggregate figure in it. Is that correct?
The specification itself, I do not. It did not. It's over $500.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
But that's the key amount, right? Over $500, under $500?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the specifications did state an amount over $500.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he didn't make an objection to the specification at trial, did he?
No, he did not, Your Honor.
And he pleaded guilty to each of those specifications?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. But I think it's relevant that while he did admit that he stole over $500, It is, you have to apply the facts of the case to the law, and Sergeant Hines had to understand how it is applying those laws that he was guilty. We have, and based off of the record as the Army Corps found, they were not clear, was not clear what it actually was he was pleading guilty to based off of the conflicting statements that were there. It's, regarding the other jurisdictional cases that we cited, the Billingsley, Papia, the government argues that these are talking about when the aggregation is in the statute, in the code. They're talking about there's two different types of aggregation. And admittedly, there are. There's aggregation of the values of larceny, and there's aggregation of the actual offenses of larceny. However, in this case, that distinction is blurred by the charge sheet, where in order to get to the over $500 amount on the charge of the family separation allowance larceny, the government had to aggregate all those payments to get some of those payments to get over that $500 mark. So we don't believe that we can simply apply the aggregation language of the code and those sections of the code and say that those only apply to the amounts or that it was only applied to the larcenies. Because again, that same distinction was blurred by the charge sheet that the government put forward. Your Honor, the government is asking this court to adopt a new law and retroactively apply it to Sergeant Hines. We do not believe that this court needs to get to the aggregation issue unless it is satisfied that the Army believes that the Army Corps abused its discretion and had clearly erroneous findings of fact. As such, we ask that the court affirm the decision of the Army Corps of Criminal Appeals.
Thank you, counsel. Government has the opportunity for a rebuttal.
Government, in your view, what is the standard of review for both of the issues?
With it being a guilty plea, Your Honor, it's whether the military judge abused his discretion, recognizing that when it comes to the aggregation issue, that's a question of law, so that's going to be de novo, even though it's under the umbrella of abuse.
Okay, so when the appellee, I guess, counsel just said that we look at whether the CCA abused its discretion, is that correct, in your view? Or piercing through the CCA and looking at the military judge's ruling?
The latter is the correct one, Your Honor. Piercing through the CCA, did the military judge abuse his discretion? If not, then the Army Corps got it wrong. This court should reverse the Army Corps. Now, I want to raise 2 points here on rebuttal. First one, I want to deal with the defense claim that the federal statutes that the government cites to, such as in Billingsley and Papia, those somehow specifically allow for aggregation, whereas Article 121 does not. If you look at the Billingsley case, pages 517, 518 of the hardbound opinion, that deals with 18 U.S.C. section 665, the opinion excerpts part of that statute. And if you look at it there, it's not a matter of here's how we determine one offense versus several offenses. The aggregation you're talking about isn't really aggregation. It's if you steal below this amount, here's your sentence. If you steal above this amount. Similar to what we have in Article 121, if it's military property less than $500, here's your penalty. If it's more than $500, it's a greater penalty. That's really all it's talking about. So Section 665 in Billingsley doesn't allow for aggregation, just like Article 121 doesn't. The issues in all those cases the government cites is, are we looking at one offense, or are we looking at several offenses? And the federal law is not different from military law in this case. If you're looking at several offenses, you can't aggregate several thefts. But if it's one ongoing offense, you can aggregate the amount because it's one offense. So I just want to make clear that that's the government's position in defense is misreading the federal law and misunderstanding the government's argument on that point. Second of all, with respect to the defense's position that the government could charge on diverse occasions. Well, they're absolutely right that the government can charge on diverse occasions, but the government is by no means required to charge on diverse occasions. That is a matter of prosecutorial discretion. So if we have an appellant who's been stealing BAH at $400 a month for 4 years, well, sure, the government could charge. You stole BAH less than $500 diverse occasions, and you're limited to that sentence. Or if the government wants to charge every single month as its own specification and hit that appellant with 48 convictions, that's absolutely permissible. And there's really no UNC argument there for the defense in that position because if the Army Corps' opinion is affirmed and its logic is upheld, if it's a separate offense every month, it by definition cannot be UNC. It's not substantially one transaction. It is separate transactions. However, the Lopresti test avoids all these issues. If it's intent to steal several items at once, D The theft arises out of a single act of fraud, and payment is made on a recurring basis. That's an ongoing theft. There's only one proper way to charge that. And it ends up being the best of both worlds, as discussed previously, because the appellant's punitive exposure and the number of convictions he has is limited, but the government is permitted to seek a sentence that accurately encapsulates his criminality. Any further questions?
No further questions. Thank you. The court thanks both counsel. Case is now submitted and will stand in recess until 15:15. Thank you very much.
The court stands in recess until 11:15 a.m.